You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. This is Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to learn something, do something, be something, experience something. And I know we all experienced Mars last night, which is fantastic. We got to hear about curiosity and that successful, super successful landing. And we're all about space right now. We're all astronauts and scientists right now. But I have a real scientist on the line to talk about NASA and curiosity and your curiosity and everything. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome a scientist from NASA Ames, Mr. Tori Holler. Welcome.
Thanks, Marilyn. Thanks for having me on the program.
Oh, no. Thank you for being there. First of all, once again, congratulations. I was watching the stream last night when they got the news that it landed. Everybody just erupted, and all the stops were up. People were crying. It was fantastic because there's so many moving parts to that project that just one thing going wrong would have scuttled the entire thing. So that meant that everyone brought their A game. So again, congratulations.
Yeah, it was a pretty good day to be a NASA person yesterday. You know, I mean, so a lot of days I come into work, and it's kind of like coming into work anywhere else.
Uh-huh.
Yesterday was not one of those days. Yesterday I came into work at a place that still is capable of doing really extraordinary things.
So when you came in yesterday, there was still that. It was all still a mystery. It was all still a big stress where, is it going to work? Is it not going to work? So were people fairly confident, or was there the fear?
You know, a lot of people were really holding their breath about this. It's kind of two things stacked up against one another. One is landing on Mars is just an exceptionally hard thing to do. And although we have done it before, and I think people's sense of expectation about it is kind of tempered by the recent success that we've had,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't make it any easier. And
right.
This was a big, as you said, a big, complicated, complex mission with a brand new entry, descent, and landing system. Something very difficult to do, but stacked up against that, just some of the most brilliant engineers anywhere. And so, you know, although people were holding their breath, we knew that if anyone was capable of doing this, it was the engineers that we had working on this project.
Okay.
So, you know, and the other thing I would try to convey to your listeners is, it's easy to think of you know, this is just kind of a chunk of machinery that's flying to Mars, but it really is carrying people's careers and their dreams with it. I mean, the instruments that are present on this rover, people have been working on these for a decade or more.
Really
have just poured their careers into it. Well, like the one that I'm involved with, the Kemen instrument.
And what is that?
So Kemen is an instrument that will examine mineralogy and chemistry on Mars. And the best way to think about this is, there's a story that's written into the rocks in Mars. We have a record stretching back more than 4 billion years of history on Mars that is waiting there to be read in the rocks, as long as you have the right way of reading it. And, you know, some of this is simply understandable in the shape of the rocks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, your listeners have probably had the experience of, you know, picking up a cobble that's rounded, and you know it's rounded because it's been sitting in a riverbed or in the surf zone or something like that. So some things you can tell from shape, and we've been able to do that in the past with orbital images and things like that. But there are deeper layers of information that are locked up inside the rock, and in particular, Curiosity's job is to try to understand something about conditions that existed there in the past. And one of the best ways to do that is to look at the minerals and the chemistry that are in there, because those really lock up information. They record information about the conditions in which they formed.
Okay, I have a billion questions for you, and you've now introduced some more. So let me ask you, when you are sending something, you're sending it to another planet, and ostensibly there would be things on another planet that don't exist here. So how can you know how to analyze what you don't know?
Yeah, it's possible, you know, that you could encounter something you don't know, and you always have to be at least prepared for that possibility. So I think what you do to address this is you try to send instruments that are capable of seeing and identifying as broad a spectrum of possibility as you can envision.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's special about this mission, so Curiosity is much bigger than the MER rovers. The MER rovers were about the size of a riding lawnmower, maybe.
Okay.
Curiosity is almost the size of a car. And with that bigger size comes much more capability And in particular, two of the instruments, the Kemen and SAM instruments, they have the capability to ingest samples from the surface and do a much more detailed analysis than we've been able to do on Mars in the past.
Okay.
And both of those instruments, so the Kemen instrument and the SAM instrument, are of a type that is at least conceivably capable of identifying almost any material you can think of, whether known or unknown. Practically speaking, that's a little bit harder to do because you're going to run into examples where you have mixtures of multiple kinds of things, so many kinds of minerals or chemicals, and that makes it a little bit more challenging to tease apart the signal of exactly what's in there. But in particular with minerals, Earth itself has a very, very diverse array of minerals, much broader than we expect to find on Mars or elsewhere, and that gives us some confidence that almost anything we're going to see we're likely to have encountered here on Earth and know how to identify it.
Now, why is that that one would think that a distant planet would have new and exciting things? Why would the Earth have more things than Mars?
Yeah, in some ways, I think your sense is correct. Certainly, when we're talking about a different place, a different environment, we expect different sorts of minerals and materials to form there. But one of the cool things about the Earth is that it's such a diverse place in terms of the environments that it has. So minerals, as they form, are very reflective of the conditions in which they form. So the temperature, the pressure, whether or not it's acidic or basic or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And by very nature of how many processes we have here on Earth, and in fact, partly by nature of the fact that we have life here on Earth, we have an incredibly large number of different processes, an incredible diversity of environmental conditions
mm-hmm.
that really encompasses a very broad range of what we might expect to find on Mars. And it's worth saying, you know, Mars and Earth certainly are different, and they followed different paths in their evolution. But at a pretty fundamental level, they're quite similar. So they formed in a similar way from similar materials.
Okay.
You know, geology, chemistry, physics, those things work the same regardless of where you are. And
not
so,
if you ask a creationist, but I digress.
Yeah. So you know, although Mars is certainly a new place, and one of the things that makes it exciting is the possibility for new discoveries. What we're doing, we're not doing in complete isolation. We do have the context of understanding how all these processes work on Earth
mm-hmm.
and understanding what the minerals and chemistry look like on Earth. And that gives us a pretty strong background for doing what we're going to do on Mars.
Excellent. You're listening to 89.5 FM, KPOO, San Francisco. We're speaking with Tori Holler, who's a scientist at NASA Ames Research. Now, I heard somewhere along the line when people were talking about Mars that the first things that went out there, well, basically that there was climate differences depending on where you land in the planet. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, well, of course, Mars is like Earth in the sense that it has an equator and poles, and there are temperature differences, places where it's colder or warmer. There's a lot of elevation difference across Mars, and so you can have places where the atmosphere is thicker or thinner. That, in part, actually dictates where you can land on the planet's surface because
mm-hmm.
the atmosphere is part of what helps you slow down and get to where you're going. And so so it's really places that are lower in elevation that
mm-hmm.
are a little bit more accessible to us. So of course there are variations, and Mars, just as Earth does, has seasons. It has different regions with different climates, and overall it's a much, much colder and drier place than Earth is.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to think of any place at all that's remotely like it, you might think of something like Antarctica. But the chilliest day in Antarctica is something like the best day on Mars.
Oh, okay. So is there water on Mars?
It's likely that there is water on Mars, but it depends what you mean by that statement. So is there liquid water on the surface of Mars? What we know about Mars and the Martian atmosphere is that it's so thin and the pressure is so small that liquid water can't exist. It's not stable on the surface of Mars. So even if you took a pail of water
mm-hmm.
and dumped it out on the surface, it would either freeze and or evaporate in pretty rapid
wow.
order. So there's no liquid water on the surface of Mars. Almost certainly there is water in the form of ice. So the Phoenix lander that went to Mars a couple of years ago seemed to discover evidence of solid ice up in the high latitudes. And that leads people to think that perhaps there is still water there under the surface. And just as on Earth, if you started going down into the subsurface, mm-hmm. as you do here, for example, in mines or things like that, the temperature starts going up as you get closer to the middle of the Earth. And you don't have to go very far down before you start feeling this effect. And the same thing is likely true on Mars. So if you started going down deeper into the Martian subsurface, maybe hundreds of meters or kilometers or so, ultimately you'd reach a place where the temperature was warm enough to have liquid water stable, and as well the pressure high enough to have liquid water stable. So there's a good reason to believe, based partly on observations of ice up near the poles, and then on what we understand about the physics and chemistry of water, that at some places in the subsurface, there's liquid water.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the Phoenix. Is that still broadcasting, or has that gone dark?
Truthfully, I don't know. You know, I think that Phoenix has run through its prime mission, and a lot of the science that it was intended to do has passed. One of the challenging things about the Phoenix lander, I was able to give some really unique science because of going up to the polar regions, mm-hmm. but those regions also impose some unique challenges. It's particularly cold. Seasonally, you have times where it becomes very dark and very cold, and that creates unique challenges for the lander. So I think that it's run through its prime mission. I don't know whether there's any contact with it anymore.
Okay, so for Curiosity, what is its prime mission, and then are there any sort of secondary missions that it has assigned to it?
Yeah, so the prime mission for Curiosity will last about 2 Earth years.
Okay.
This is designed to be a very robust spacecraft that has a great roving capability. So the MER rovers were supposed to last for about a year, and I think between the two of them, maybe supposed to go a kilometer or something like that. Curiosity is supposed to last minimally for 2 years and be able to go tens of kilometers, 30 kilometers or more,
okay.
Which really gives you access to a fantastic array of places in which to do science.
Well, let me ask you, just not to derail you, but you say it can go on and on. So I imagine there are sensors there that keep it from, say, driving off a cliff or crashing into the side of a mountain. How do you keep it from hurting itself?
Yeah, so part of it is that the science team and the engineering team are constantly assessing the environment around the rover, mm-hmm. To make an attempt to understand, you know, is this a safe place to drive? Is that a safe place to go? So at the scale of what you might hope to accomplish in a single drive, you know, of tens of meters or hundreds of meters or so, we've done the very best we can based on remote data to figure out what the hazards might be there.
Okay.
But the rover itself also has some built-in capability to navigate, avoid hazards, do that sort of thing. And so you rely in part on the human element to help you understand what's a safe place to go and the right thing to do, and then in part on the rover's inbuilt capabilities to help itself.
So does that mean there's somebody 24/7 monitoring what's going on with Curiosity?
Oh, absolutely. More than just somebody. Many people monitoring the health of the rover all the time.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Now, I have a question about our understanding of Mars. What would you say would be the biggest change in the way we as a nation or you as a scientist, what's the biggest change in terms of what you thought about Mars and what the previous probes have taught you?
Well, so you mean what is it that Curiosity can tell us that we haven't known before?
Or what is it that scientists used to think this, and then, you know, 5 years ago or 2 years ago when they sent Mir or Phoenix or whatever, they went, oh my goodness, this totally revolutionizes what we think about Mars.
Yeah, there is a constantly evolving body of knowledge, and it's worth knowing that one of the things that makes Mars really cool is we don't have just a mission to Mars. We have a program of missions to Mars, and they're built in a very sequential, complementary way.
Mm-hmm.
So each one gives us differing pieces of information, puzzle pieces that all begin to fit together. And so each mission has given us, I think, something new to kind of latch onto. And the MER missions were important in that, you know, we had some senses from looking at pictures from high orbit that water may have flowed on the surface of Mars in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But not until we got down there with the rovers were we really able to convince ourselves comprehensively that, yes, we see, you know, 3 or 4 individual independent lines of evidence, all of which point to water having formed this environment. So for a good long while, NASA's approach to exploring Mars and other bodies in the solar system was to look for places, try to find places where liquid water has existed in the past. And that interest and focus comes largely from the notion that life depends on liquid water, that would be an important checkbox. And MER has done a sensationally good job of finding environments that likely had liquid water in the past. So now Curiosity represents the next step, and part of the reason for its being bigger and more capable is that a logical next step now is to say, well, we know water is important for life, but it's not the only thing that's needed for life. Of course, you need food as well, and you need climate conditions. And so to take the next step, to look for sources of energy or prior sources of energy, to look for the elements that compose life, to try to understand what the conditions were like in the past, takes a different suite of instruments, and that's what we're trying to do with Curiosity.
Okay. What would you say, for you personally, what would you say would be the most surprising thing that you've learned about Mars, you know, based on your education as a scientist?
Yeah, I one of the things that I think is really neat about Mars is a lot of the way it works is something that's understandable in reference to the way that Earth works. And part of the interest in Mars is that Earth and Mars do share very similar origins. They may have been very similar in their early history. And so, in a sense, it's finding that everything we know as we investigate Mars deeper and deeper corresponds to our experiences on Earth. We can see the same kinds of processes that have shaped Earth in evidence in the rock record on Mars is in itself a little bit surprising, because as you said earlier, you know, this is a different place and it's far away, and shouldn't things be much different there? And they are at some level, but at a more fundamental level, things are very much the same. So, of course, there are surprises that come along, and we find things. For example, there was a report some years ago that methane may be in the atmosphere of Mars, and it's not clear whether that's true or not. Curiosity, in fact, will tell us whether that's true. But there would be a finding where, gosh, everything that we understand about atmospheric chemistry on Mars and the processes that are likely to be happening make that quite a surprise to see, and something that's really interesting to follow up. And Curiosity already had the instruments capable of making those measurements before this surprise came along.
You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. We're speaking with scientist Tori Holler from NASA Ames Research. Now, you said number one, that people have been working on this for at least a decade. And you also said there's a sequence of missions. So where is Curiosity in the sequence, and what's coming next?
Yeah, so our history of looking at Mars is almost as old as I am. We landed the Viking landers there in 1976.
Okay, was that when you were born?
I'm a little bit older than that, unfortunately, okay. but there's not too much difference.
Okay.
So we had quite a long hiatus, but then we really had a renewed focus on Mars beginning in the mid-90s and have had quite a record of success and achievement since then. So beginning with the Pathfinder lander in 1996, that was about the size of a little red wagon, maybe.
Uh-huh.
And then the MER rovers in 2003, riding lawnmowers, if you want to think of them that way. And now Curiosity. But those are just the landers, and they come in the context of a bigger science program that also involves orbiters. And the way to think of this is they're very complementary, because an orbiter gives you a global view of what's going on, pictures from all over the surface of Mars. So much, in fact, with the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and its incredibly high-resolution camera, that there's almost too much for us to look at.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, a great global context on Mars that's given to us by these orbital elements, and then we can pick and choose our spots. And so the choice of Gale Crater, I think, was in the history of exploration, it's probably unprecedented in terms of how well targeted and thought through a landing site it is, because we had such a great ability to characterize not only that site but other sites of interest to us. That all of a sudden, you're not going into a place with no knowledge of what you're going to encounter, or no sense of what to expect, or even if it's going to be a safe place to land. We already know a lot about Gale Crater. And now we're going down to add the complement to that knowledge.
And how did you learn? Did you learn from other probes? Or how did you learn about, like, how did you know that Gale Crater was the one?
Yeah, so there are a number of orbital assets, so spacecraft that are circling the planet with very good cameras, with mm-hmm. science instruments that can tell you a little bit about the chemistry in that environment. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to have a look. And you know, if you fly, for example, over the desert southwest in a plane, you can see evidence of all kinds of geology just with your own eyes. You can see things that look like dry riverbeds and that sort of thing. So we had that kind of view of not only Gale Crater, but a wide variety of other places. But as well, we were able to look with different eyes, with eyes that in essence see the chemistry of the environment, mm-hmm. At least at some level. And so not only did we have evidence that comes in the form of the shape of the landforms in the environment, but we had chemical evidence that tells us that, hey, this is a place that is very chemically diverse. It means there are likely a lot of processes at work in forming that environment. And if your interest is in understanding the kinds of processes that shaped the early history of Mars, mm-hmm. including whether or not those processes could have supported life, what you want to do, I think, is go to an environment that is as diverse as possible, that gives you an insight into as many of those processes as you can encounter in one spot.
Okay. You're listening to 89.5 FM, KPOO, San Francisco. We have scientist Tori Holler on the line. Now, let me ask a little bit about you. How long have you been a scientist, and was NASA your original goal, or was it just something you sort of stumbled into?
Yeah, you
if
know,
you can stumble into NASA.
Yeah, they don't like you to stumble around here. You know, it's interesting. I mean, I guess there are two answers to the question. How long have I been a professional scientist? I got to Ames about 13 years ago.
Okay.
But I guess I would say that I've been a scientist all my life. And in fact, I think that little kids are the best kind of scientists there are, because they really are driven by their own curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And every kid, you know, when they kind of poke and test the environment around them, they're following the scientific method of sorts, even if they know nothing about it. And so I was fortunate to grow up in places where I really could explore the environment around me. So
where was that?
Well, so I was born in the Bahamas and lived there until I was about six.
And lush and tropical and nice.
Yeah, of places to be born, it's not a bad one.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I really had a lot of opportunity to be around the ocean at that time, and part of my career path took me into oceanography for a while. And so, you know, I just have kind of followed my nose. And even though I always was interested in space, and I think the first science project that I ever did in school, I was in fifth grade when the Voyager probe passed by Jupiter, and I was just fascinated by it.
Now, was that something where your family said, okay, we're going to go watch this? Or was this something where you told your family, we're going to go watch this?
You know, I think it was just something that I kind of encountered on my own. I don't know what initially gave me the spark or anything like that, but I became very interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And although space was an interest for me, it never occurred to me to try to make NASA a specific goal. I just kind of, by following my nose into what interested me next,
mm-hmm.
I found myself here. And you know, it was remarkable. I gave a sort of career perspective talk to a group of students not long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I described my own interest as a kid, completely exclusive of what I do now. But it's so easy to see what I do now, both in terms of where I work and the kinds of science that I focus on, as deriving directly from what fascinated me and interested me as a kid.
Wow.
And, you know, and how much better does it get than that, being able to do exactly what you love?
So now when kids find out that you work at NASA, they must have a billion questions for you. Aren't you like the coolest dad on the block during, like, you know, career day? What does your dad do? Well, he's a scientist at NASA.
Yeah, that's my son loves to say, you know, my daddy's a planet scientist. And so yesterday here at Ames, in association with the Curiosity Landing, we had a big public event. And it was a great day for me, not only because of the science and the success of the landing, but because it showed me that, you know, we opened up the gates of Ames and thousands of people came to share the day with us. And many of them families, and, you know, we had booths set up to describe Ames' various contributions to the mission. And for 4 or 5 hours straight, there was a crowd 4 and 5 deep standing around the, you know, the booth where I and others were working, wanting to know about these instruments and what we're going to learn on Mars, and, you know, and picking up examples of the kinds of rocks that we think we might find there. And it just was really encouraging and refreshing to see that what we're doing here still captures people's imaginations, and nowhere more than with children.
And from what I understand, in Times Square, people were chanting, "Science, science, science," which I bet you don't get that a lot.
I wish I had been there to hear that. You know, what I told people at the public event last night was I realized that we were stacked up against the Olympic coverage and in fact, you know, against the men's 100-meter final. So what I'm going to tell people one day is that I competed against Usain Bolt on the day of the men's 100-meter final.
And you won.
And I won, yeah.
And tell me a little bit about the energy in the room when it turned out that everything worked. Because there was that moment where they were talking about what was going on and someone said, well, we have no more information. And I think there was about a minute and a half before it was supposed to land. And it was just kind of quiet. And then all of a sudden, people went nuts.
Yeah, we had this. So what we did here at Ames, right as you first come in the front gate, there's kind of a big grassy mall area. And that's where we held this public event, and we put up big screens at either end. And the several thousand people basically, you know, put out picnic blankets on the mall. So everybody was, you know, kind of sitting there under their blankets in the dark watching, just absolutely glued to these screens. You know, really kind of biting their fingernails, and then the whole place just erupted when it went up, you know, and even people who had been kind of a little bit cavalier about, oh, you know, it's, you know, it is what it is, all of a sudden we're just really caught up in it. You know, and I personally, you know, there were many things that I experienced at that point. I was excited about the science that I know is ahead. I was proud of my colleagues here at Ames for their contributions that made this happen, and likewise people at NASA centers and other places around the world. And I think more than anything, I was happy for the colleagues and friends of mine who have put their careers into this mission and saw it land safely on the surface of Mars. And it was, you know, I can only imagine what it was like to be in the shoes of a person who comes into work and has, you know, 15 years of work all hinging on 2 minutes of landing on the surface. And as well, the next 3 or 4 years of focus of their scientific career all comes down to those couple of minutes. It was quite an amazing moment.
And it kept going. It seemed to be people, I think those cavalier people were just steeling themselves against disappointment. And so then when everything went well, they could finally enjoy it.
I think that's true, you know, and it really didn't end there, because I came in this morning and I watched another briefing from the Jet Propulsion Lab down in Pasadena, and just when I thought I'd been wowed as much as I could by the technological accomplishment of all of this, they put up a picture, and the picture was taken from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. So this is the orbiter that has a telescope that looks down on the planet.
Okay.
And in the picture, you could see the Curiosity spacecraft and its parachute.
Oh my God.
As it was in the middle of landing.
Oh my God!
So, you know, how I think that, you know, we're a little bit jaded because we're so used to kind of the Hollywood view of things, where, well, of course you would see that, you know, we're expecting to see the landing on Mars, but it is an absolutely remarkable accomplishment to have been able to follow the lander with telemetry and hear its heartbeat literally all the way down to the surface, and then to be able to see a picture of it happening from 100 million miles away, that is really quite something.
That's just completely nuts. I mean, who would have thought back in, you know, Puritan times that not only could you put a man on the moon, but you could send things to Mars and just take pictures of it.
Yeah, you know, and one of the cool things about this was it just worked out this way that right over one of the screens, so there was a big screen at either end of the field here, right over one of the screens, you could actually see Mars up in the sky. I don't know if any of your listeners were looking out last night, but there was a really kind of conspicuous triangle up in the sky, and the bottom right corner of it was bright red, and that's the planet Mars. And so to be seeing this live feed from the control room and know what was going on, but then actually be looking at the planet with your own eyes and realize you were looking at this sort of drama unfolding really was quite amazing, too. And the Mars that was up in the sky was sitting just over the shoulder of the screen where all this remarkable stuff was taking place.
And then not only that, then Curiosity itself was sending back pictures. First it sent that that really dusty picture, and then it looked like it was sending a picture that was a shadow, that it was its own shadow.
Yeah.
So I loved that. And what I also loved about the whole experience was how the Twitter sphere and Facebook, like almost immediately people were going, oh, don't worry. You know, the first time you take a picture, it's always of your foot. And they were talking about Curiosity. There was like hundreds of people just talking about Curiosity and making jokes about it, you know, like it's a member of the family.
Yeah, it's kind of the amazing thing about this go-around that I don't think was true even back in 2003 when the Mir rovers landed, is now, because of the way the technology works, it really is possible for almost everybody to be involved with this in almost real time.
Yes.
You know, so the pictures that the public saw last night, you know, all of you saw those pictures within a few minutes of when the scientists in the control room saw them themselves for the first time. And all of a sudden, it is not just the science team that has a chance to comment on them, but everybody around the world. You know, people, I heard speculations about, oh, I wonder if that's the mountain in the background or if that's the such and such. And what a remarkable thing, you know, for everybody all around the world to be seeing these images and sharing their ideas about them almost in real time.
And not only that, it's remarkable to know how many science geeks there are out there. Just on a day-to-day, you're just walking along, oh, like, you know, half a dozen people just in 5 minutes all commented on Curiosity. And it coming from places you would not normally expect. People think that no one's interested in science, but there's all these people who just think it's fascinating, and all these children who think it's fascinating. And speaking of kids, how are there things out there for children to look at that will maybe help them understand more about Curiosity and more about NASA?
Yeah, I think NASA pays very close attention to making what we do, and we really recognize as an agency that it's important to be able to communicate back to everybody in the public what it is we're doing and why it's important and why people should care. And in particular, we recognize that it's important to do that for kids. Mm-hmm. And so NASA's websites, for starters, will have all kinds of information that is designed for kids or for teachers in order to be able to pass along to kids. And so certainly there's a lot of that kind of information accessible.
Okay. Now let's get back to Curiosity. I know I'm keeping you from NASA, you know, jubilation, but this is just so exciting for me.
Yeah, of course.
So you mentioned that it's part of a series. So what's the next step after Curiosity?
Well, the next step we know for sure will be an orbital mission called MAVEN.
Okay.
MAVEN is designed to understand something about the upper atmosphere of Mars. And although that kind of sounds a little sort of esoteric, it actually will have a lot to teach us about the evolution of the planet. So why is it that the atmosphere has evolved in the way that it has? Why is it a red planet today? Things like that. So that one we know. That's been under development and is going to launch. The opportunities that come down the line after that, and because of the relative orbits of Earth and Mars, mm-hmm. there's an opportunity about every 26 months or so to launch a mission to Mars.
Okay.
So, you know, there'll be one in 2014 and 2016 and 2018. What exactly we will do for those opportunities is still being worked out. And in part, the findings of Curiosity itself will help feed into that process because it really will tell us, you know, have we found a place where we should be focusing our future efforts?
Mm-hmm.
What are the sorts of instruments that we ought to package up and send along with this next thing? So over the next handful of months, maybe up through about the new year or so, there's going to be an intense amount of effort dedicated to working out what the future Mars program should look like.
Okay, and then my next question is which of these two is more what NASA would like to do? Do they want to eventually get a person on Mars, or do they want to eventually go to another planet first?
Well, so we have a process called the decadal survey process, where the whole scientific community, the planetary sciences community, is polled as to their notions about what ought to be done. Mm-hmm. And I think the first part of the answer to your question is those are two very different objectives. So
yes.
Sending people to Mars is more about human exploration, human future, what we are capable of in terms of extending out into our solar system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a different, you know, a linked but a different objective from trying to understand scientifically the solar system around us. And so Mars unquestionably remains an interesting place to go. In scientific terms, one of the things that you might ultimately want to do if you continue to find evidence that suggests maybe this is a place where life could have arisen and taken hold, maybe something you want to do is go and collect a piece of the surface and bring it back to Earth, where you could throw a series of very capable analyses at it and make a good stab at saying, you know, is there any evidence that life was there in the past? But there are many, many other interesting places in the solar system, including, if you use the interest in life as a guide, including other places that we think conditions might have been suitable or might still be suitable for life to develop. And so some places in the outer solar system, moons of Jupiter and Saturn, also fit the bill. And ideally, we would not have to choose between those. You know, of course, these things cost money, and we have to be careful about our priorities and how they're thought through and what it is that's driving our interest in those given places. You know, but we also have the benefit of time, and so we can take our time and explore around, and we have had a good balance in the past of looking at the inner solar system, Mars and Venus to some extent, as well as the outer solar system. And I, for one, certainly hope that will continue. You know, we as well, in addition to planetary exploration, have an entire universe around us that is there for the exploring. And we really have done a pretty remarkable job of doing that as well. And that part of things will continue too.
Excellent. Now, for people out there who want to find out more or maybe monitor the progress of Curiosity, where can they look?
Yeah, I know for sure that NASA is having daily press briefings from JPL basically every day this week, I think.
What's JPL?
JPL is the Jet Propulsion Lab. So that's the organization that is managing the mission for NASA. So mission controlled, if you want to think of it that way.
Okay.
And this is where a good bit of the science team is. It's where most of the engineers are located, and it's where the data is initially coming down and analyzed. And so each day, I think they intend to have a press briefing at 9 in the morning. That's a great place to get information, and I know that information will come available as well on the NASA website, and probably largely into newspapers and news outlets as well.
And if people want to see the pictures that Curiosity's taken left, right, and sideways?
The NASA website would be the place to go.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you so much. I know we went way over the time that I said we would do this, but you were just so, the whole subject is just so fascinating.
Oh, you're most welcome. This was fun.
Okay, so Tori Holler, scientist
right.
at NASA Ames Research, I want to thank you so much for all that you've done. And is there anything you'd like to throw out to our audience before we part?
You know, a couple of things that I would say. The first is that I want people to think of this mission in terms of the human component, that it's not just machinery sent to Mars, that it is you know, people and their dedication and their achievement that has gone to Mars. And as well, I would like everyone to understand that this is not just NASA's mission, this is their mission as well. You know, this is something that we as a people, driven by our curiosity and our notion that it's important to pursue grand endeavors like this, have done. And so this is for everybody.
Well, now that opens a question up. Are there people out there who say, why are we spending all this money going in space when we could be doing blah, blah, blah? I know that children are willing to explore everything, but maybe the people, maybe older people might not necessarily be as inclined to find that out?
Yeah, that's a really important question. I think that everybody should be asking. You could ask that of almost any of the priorities that our nation has for spending. Every time you spend a dollar in one place, you're choosing not to spend it in another place. Space exploration is one part of that. I think that in this case, it simply is a part of who we are. And by we, I don't mean NASA and I don't mean Americans. I mean just people everywhere. I think it's a part of who we are to be curious about the world and the universe around us, to want to do and be a part of grand things. And I think that in a case like this, you know, spending the money to, you know, to retain that fundamental part of who we are is important. And, you know, it's important to realize as well, we didn't package up, you know, a couple of billion dollars and send it off to Mars. That money was spent here on technology and on people. It was an investment in our ability to do technology. And so, although there are other places the money could have been spent, I think, you know, the senior scientist or the chief scientist on the mission, John Grotzinger, had a really nice statistic last night. He said if you take the cost of the mission and divide it by the number of people in the country, it's cheaper than all of those people going to see a movie. It's about $7 a person. And you know, for less than the cost of going to see a movie, what a remarkable accomplishment.
Yes.
You know, so I, for one, think that we retain a fundamental part of who we are by engaging in grand endeavors like this.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much for being on the show today. And I wish you all the scientific success in your future endeavors.
All right. Thank you, Marilyn.
Thank you. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Hey, folks, we're on Mars.
Écoutez, à midi.
Quelle heure est-il ?
Il est midi.
C'est l'heure de déjeuner.
Qu'est-ce qu'il y a à manger ?
Des saucisses. Sans doute.
Écoutez et répétez. À midi. À midi. À midi.
Quelle heure est-il ? Quelle heure ? Quelle heure est-il ? Est-il ? Quelle heure est-il ?
Il est midi, midi, midi. Il est midi. Il est midi.
C'est l'heure de déjeuner. C'est l'heure. C'est l'heure de déjeuner. De déjeuner. C'est l'heure de déjeuner.
Qu'est-ce qu'il y a à manger ?